from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Saturday marks the one-year anniversary of the death of Breonna Taylor, who was killed by Louisville Metro Police during a raid on her apartment. Her death and that of other African Americans at the hands of police sparked months of racial justice protests. This weekend, numerous events are planned in Louisville and elsewhere to mark the anniversary of her death. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll be joined by Tamika Palmer, Breonna's mother, who will talk about her daughter's impact on the fight against racial injustice. We'll also discuss the role of black women in the social justice and racial justice movements. And we're going to spend some time talking about grief, grief caused by racism, and grief over the loss of loved ones over the past year from COVID-19. We want to hear from you, too, this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. It is good to have you with us here in the Louisville area, and as always, welcome to those of you listening to our Kentucky Public Radio partner stations out in the state and region. Glad you're with us today. Later in the show, Tamika Palmer will join us. Her daughter, Breonna Taylor, was fatally shot by Louisville police 1 year ago tomorrow, and her hometown of Louisville and the world will be marking that anniversary with numerous events. Ms. Palmer will be with us in the second segment of the show. And later in the program, we're going to talk about grief, dealing with grief amid this coronavirus pandemic and amid racism and racial violence. That's coming up later in the program. First, we're going to talk about activism related to racial justice and social justice, particularly that of black women in these movements. They were certainly in the spotlight during last year's protest after the deaths of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and others, but they, including the two guests you're about to meet, will be quick to tell you they've been at this a long time before then. And Marlisha Woods is with us. She is a Louisville-based visual artist and teaching artist. She's the owner of L's and O's Storytelling Gallery, among many other things. Marlisha specializes in connected people and ideas, as she puts it, through her grassroots initiative, Art Teaches Me. Marlisha Woods, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Jada Hampton is with us. She is president of the Kentucky NAACP Youth and College State Conference. She was active in helping get out the vote in the 2020 elections and in the protest movement following the death of Breonna Taylor last year here in Louisville. Jada Hampton, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And, of course, we want to hear from our listeners as well. You can reach us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. What are your thoughts as this anniversary of Breonna Taylor's death approaches? Where do we stand as a state, as a nation, as a world in terms of racial justice? What work lies ahead? We'd like to hear what you think. Call us 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you'd rather do it that way. Our handle is WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. Let me start with you, Marlisha, and if it's okay, we'll be on a first-name basis with everyone. Tell us a little bit about your art practice and what you do here in Louisville, Marlisha.
Okay. Well, Rick, I am an interdisciplinary artist. I primarily am a visual artist, and I create abstract and figurative work. Abstract is more conceptual, and figurative can be in the form of a portrait. I create wearable art for the Muhammad Ali Center, and when I'm not creating or designing art, I'm teaching. I'm a teaching artist. And I collaborate with nonprofit organizations throughout the year. And on top of that, I do a bit of community research.
Talk about how do you think Breonna Taylor's death has impacted art in the Louisville community, especially for artists of color? We've really seen an explosion of art in every medium, haven't we, since her death last year?
Yes, we have, Rick. I have some very interesting thoughts on that. And so, essentially, art has been created on mass levels in various platforms, right? So we're celebrating her life, and we're processing grief all of the while. We're aware, most minority artists are aware, that black and brown bodies are typically commodified. And so there has been a heightened sensitivity towards that, like what art is produced, How is it produced, and what is the reason for it being produced? And I just challenge all artists to critically consider how art can heal. It's a healing agent. It's not used to fetishize pain. We're processing trauma through that art, and we can do that responsibly.
Well, we're going to talk about grief later in the show, but art is certainly one way to express grief, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Well, do you find that this has changed, the events of the past year has changed how people look at your work as an artist who is a Black woman?
I believe that in general, artists, any artist that is considered a racially identified minority in many capacities in Louisville, they were in very small spaces, not necessarily seen, not visible. The works at times were exploited. And so this has opened up a pathway for artists to communicate their art for the greater good. And it exposed a lot in the art sector among all industries.
And Jada Hampton, let me turn to you, and then we'll come back to you, Marlisha. But tell us about the work you're doing right now and your role as a Youth and College State Conference President for the Kentucky NAACP.
Yes. So currently we are training up young leaders. We're getting people, young folks out, essentially teaching them things that we normally won't learn in school. We're holding police accountable, our elected officials accountable. We are putting together events, and we're just overall going out into our communities and taking in the information that we've learned and teaching it to others.
So talk about how your work has been impacted since the death of Breonna Taylor, or do you feel it has changed since her death last March?
Yes. We are now seeing more folks being able to turn to us to get more involved with the NAACP, and just not even NAACP, but organizations or within their community itself. We're seeing a lot of young leaders being created in this movement, and so that has definitely been an impact. Being able to all use our voices collectively to show that we are here and we are the youth of now and the leaders of now.
And as for you, as a Black woman close in age to Breonna Taylor, I believe, and I won't ask you your age, but I assume you're close in age to what she was, 26. How has that shaped the personal impact on you and the things you've been doing since then over the past year?
Oh, yes. My work with doing this, it's been scary, but I've been using it as a motivational factor just to see so many similarities. We went to the same college. I went to the University of Kentucky. I myself lived alone in the same type of apartment complex. And so just being able to know that there's laws in place that allow an officer to come and kick down my door at any given moment is what motivated me to go harder. And just not for me, but for other young women. And that's why we've seen so many Protect Black Women and Protect the Youth. It was crazy to see, but it was also motivating.
Well, it's really been energizing to see young people come out. I lived through the 60s, and I remember the young people back then. And I always wondered how that would play out if something similar happened in today's world, and it did. And I guess with the help of social media connecting people, young people have really been heavily involved in being informed and informing other people. And do you get a sense from your work with the NAACP that people are really interested in getting involved in the legislative process and the political process and becoming leaders and really tackling some of these issues?
Yes, definitely. We actually just held a conversation yesterday on Instagram Live with Representative Attica Scott, and we talked all about that. And we saw a lot of people come on to the platform asking questions and trying to figure out more ways to get involved, how to volunteer, how to even draft up or contact their legislators. So there are people that are willing, especially young people that are willing, to go and actually speak to elected officials more so now than we ever seen before.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL. We're talking to Jada Hampton, whose voice you just heard. She is the Kentucky NAACP Youth and College, with the president, I should say, of the NAACP Youth and College State Conference. Excuse me. And Marlisha Woods is with us, a visual artist and teaching artist based here in Louisville. Let me come back to you, Marlisha. I'm interested in your grassroots initiative that I touched on in the introduction, Art Teaches Me. Tell us about that.
Yes. So I am a teaching artist and as an art educator for the past 13 years. What I have seen is in many spaces, there are not teaching artists or anyone in the art education capacity many times that are racially identified minorities. So I walk in spaces knowing that I may be the only person in the room that looks like me, teaching various groups, and I do that on purpose, right? So I go places where I am the only person in the room, because people need to see what that looks like, right? They need to experience something that's different than a whitewashed education system. But then on the other flip side, I go to spaces where there are people just like me, right? They look just like me, black and brown children, families, and I go there to inspire, to encourage, and to make sure that resources and funding goes to places that are often overlooked. And so my missional purpose is to, as stated before, connect people and ideas. People have ideas. Sometimes they just don't have the resources. And sometimes they have the resources, but they don't have the know of interacting with diverse groups. And so I want to make sure that intercultural relationships and intergenerational mm-hmm. relationships are being built throughout the community on a micro level and nationwide.
So what are your plans for this weekend for marking the anniversary of Breonna Taylor's death?
My plans are to honor her respectfully. I believe that when we live in a really hyper-tech world where social media is at the forefront, we're told how to feel, what to feel, when to feel. And so everything's like a trend, right? And then once it's over, we go back to business as usual. I'm challenging other people as well as myself not to do that, right? And so I want to honor her in a way that's not going to be just one random tweet or, you know, a hashtag, but I want to consciously think of ways, pathways to make sure that her life and legacy is remembered. And so that is in some of the work that I do behind the scenes and some of the things that I planned out for this year. Any capacity that I move in where I'm making space for people that look just like her, that's how I honor her. And I don't plan on stopping anytime soon.
Jana, what about you? What are your plans? How are you going to spend this time as the community and the world honors Breonna Taylor?
Yes. So tomorrow we have an event planned where we are going to write letters to our legislators, just to amplify Breonna's law, and then to also oppose Senate Bill 211. We're also going to go out into the field and we're going to help organize and volunteer with other organizations. I know there's going to be a food drive on Sunday that we are going to be a part of. And so we're just going to keep saying her name and we're going to do some, I know we don't want to do social media posts, but we're going to do a graphic and just to honor her as well.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us and wish you well this weekend and beyond. Marlisha Woods is a visual artist and teaching artist here in Louisville. Jada Hampton is the president of the Kentucky NAACP Youth and College State Conference. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. When we return, Tamika Palmer will join us. Back with more in a moment. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, people in Breonna Taylor's hometown of Louisville and around the world will be paying tribute to her and her legacy this weekend with numerous events marking the first anniversary of her death. And joining us now on In Conversation to talk about that and other things is Tamika Palmer, Breonna's mother. Ms. Palmer, welcome to In Conversation. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, first question, may I call you Tamika during our conversation?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. This weekend, as you well know, there are a lot of events and rallies planned around the world in honor of your daughter. What message do you want most? Do you want these events to convey to from the community and from the world to convey to everyone?
Just to pretty much not to give up, to keep applying pressure, because there's been no justice, and that's what we're here for. So until we get that, we have to stay on the forefront of this, and we have to keep reminding them of why we're here and the purpose.
Well, to the extent that you're comfortable talking about this or anything else, how will you spend this time this weekend? Are you taking part in some of the public events?
Absolutely. Tomorrow there will be a rally, a march, a food giveaway. So we have a whole day of events planned as well. So I'll definitely be a part of it.
Well, I know over the past year you've been active in advocating for changes to policing, especially policies that were in play in Breonna's situation, no-knock warrants, for example. What have you seen so far that has happened that you were hoping for, and what work still needs to be done in your view? What lies ahead in terms of getting laws passed and policy changes made?
There's a lot of work still to be done. I don't think it's a thing you'll fix one or two things and it can stop. So we'll forever be a part of making sure that they are changing these laws to work for everybody, and that not just by saying you're changing them, that they're actually being applied. So with that, I think we'll forever be a part of it. As to what I've seen, well, we're still waiting, to be honest. I mean, we know that there's been policies changed, but we haven't seen, we haven't had to witness them yet, as to where, right after Breonna, they're supposed to be wearing body cams, and then David McAtee was killed, and there was no body cam footage. So, that's the job now, is to make sure that they're actually going to be applying those things and if they're not, that they're held accountable for not doing those things.
Well, I know you have a champion in Representative Attica Scott, and she has been pushing for legislation on the state level that would ban the use of no-knock warrants statewide. Actually, some other states passed them since Breonna's death. There is another bill, looks like it has more momentum, that would outlaw some no-knock warrants, but not all. I mean, are you hopeful maybe that this is something that can happen statewide at this stage of the game?
That law is crap. There's no accountability into it. I mean, it doesn't. They totally whitewashed the original bill. Like, there's no police accountability. So it'll be another time next year that we'll be right back in the same position. So I don't think it's not a bill that I would support, to be honest. It's not what we need.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the various investigations to the extent that you're able to talk to about them. The Attorney General's investigation, of course, resulted in no charges against police directly related to Breonna's death. A couple of grand jurors have come out publicly criticizing the way the case was presented to them. Now you are calling on the Commonwealth's attorney here in Jefferson County, Tom Wine, who referred the case to the Attorney General because he had a conflict of interest, to now pursue the case on his own, since the case that involved the conflict of interest is no longer there. Have you received any indication that he's willing to do that?
No, I haven't, of course not. But it definitely is what needs to happen. The whole point in Daniel Cameron was because there was a conflict. There's no longer a conflict, so now there's and to say Daniel Cameron did an investigation is an understatement, because clearly he did not do that at all, and he didn't present the case to the grand jury, which we all know from the three grand jurors coming forth.
Well, there, of course, is some folks have kind of forgotten about this. There's an ongoing parallel federal investigation basically a civil rights investigation. Have you received any indication from those folks as to when that will conclude?
I haven't heard anything of when it will be concluded, but they definitely keep in contact to let me know that they're definitely still focusing on it and that they're definitely still.
Are you there? I think we are. Tamika's phone is.
Hello.
Are you still there, Tamika?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was saying that that I haven't heard of any when it will be done, but they've definitely kept in contact to let me know that it's still a priority and that they're still doing an investigation. So I'm hopeful that something good will come from that.
Well, one thing that has happened here in Louisville over the past year has been the hiring of a new police chief, Erica Shields, who was a former chief in Atlanta and resigned following a police shooting down there. What are your thoughts about the new leadership, and have you had an opportunity to meet with Chief Shields?
I have not met with her. She's definitely she's reached out, but we haven't had the opportunity yet. But I definitely think that it requires a sit down because, you know, I know for me, I have questions for her. So in her position on being here, because she comes from Atlanta, who was dealing with a case, you know, of its own. So I definitely would like to know her position on being here.
Well, many say this is as bad as everything that is happening, and of course, there's nothing that can compensate for the loss of a child, of your child, but the resulting people taking to the streets and this fight for racial justice, this renewed fight for racial justice, many say this is an opportunity to, you know, start tearing down some of these racial barriers and cut out some of the deep roots of racism that have existed here in Louisville, especially for decades. Are you optimistic that this is kind of the start of something where we can really dig down deep and start, you know, rooting out these things that have dated back for generations?
I definitely think we are in the best position that we've ever been in to get some real change. It's just about staying focused and being able to stay a part of those conversations. I do know it won't be easy. It's never been that way for us. We've never had real opportunity. So it's just about not losing focus and not losing hope. So I'm here for the duration of it. I mean, that's all I got left in me is fight. So.
Well, we just had a segment. I don't know if you heard. You may have heard some about the role of the many black women in the racial justice movement, and over the past year, we've seen a lot of them step up, take to the streets, get involved in other ways, especially young people. Is that that's something that, as I mentioned earlier, that was really I think energizing, seeing so many young people get out and get involved in this process. Is that something that gives you optimism?
Yes, that's actually one of my favorite things to see about this whole thing, because we definitely know that it will lie with the younger people. And to see them so hopeful and so full of fight is amazing. And to be given an opportunity to use their voices. And a lot of them didn't know how or where to use them. So it's a blessing.
Let me ask you about it. I don't know how involved you are in this, about another bill that's making its way through Frankfort that's causing a lot of concern, Senate Bill 211, where it can be a crime to, according to the language, to insult the police, and it has a lot of other language in the bill as well. Is this something that you've been involved with speaking out against, or are you aware of it?
I am aware of it. I haven't dealt a lot with it, but I definitely think it's disrespectful. We've been taunted by the police for years, and nobody's ever done anything about it. So for them to feel as if somebody say a few bad words, they want to make a whole law against, they've done it to us for years. And now I definitely do not agree with if the police are holding a line or something like that, people are kicking and spitting or doing things to them. I don't agree with that at all, because, I mean, that's disrespect. But to say, to pass a whole bill to take away our First Amendment rights, like, this is insane.
Up in Minnesota, the trial of the officer charged with the death of George Floyd is underway. And, you know, because you and many others have been through similar traumas, and I'm not assuming that everyone who's been through this automatically knows one another, but has there been a reaching out between families, you know, offering support and strength?
We've definitely stood with Floyd's family. We still continue to support and be with them. I wish we can be there with them now, but, you know, as you know, they're, you know, a lot of their own family hasn't been able to stand together on that, but I definitely stand with them and support them, and if they ever should need me, I'm there.
Well, Breonna's legacy is impacting people everywhere, and that's certainly true in the art world. You may have heard part of our conversation with the Marlisha Woods a few minutes ago, but there's a big exhibit coming up at the Speed Art Museum honoring Breonna, and I know you and your family are supporting that effort, right?
Absolutely. It's just amazing to think that, I mean, to even picture her in this museum. Like, who would have thought?
Well, we I want to thank you for joining us, Tamika Palmer, and we wish you peace and comfort this weekend. I know it's a very difficult weekend for you and for your family, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Okay, no problem. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much. Tamika Palmer, mother of Breonna Taylor, it was 1 year ago today that Breonna was shot and killed during a raid on her apartment by Louisville Metro Police. Numerous events around the country, around the state, of course, here in Louisville and around the world are being held this weekend to mark that anniversary. We've been doing a series of reports this week, our reporting team at WFPL and Louisville Public Media, about the death of Breonna Taylor and the marking of the anniversary, and you can find all of those at WFPL.org. But let's listen to something that WFPL's John Boyle filed this morning. Tomorrow, again, marks the 1 year since Louisville Metro Police killed Breonna Taylor. And John Boyle has more on how local protesters are planning to pay respects to Breonna Taylor.
Demonstrators marched through the streets of Louisville every day through the summer of 2020, calling for justice for Breonna Taylor. But as winter took hold, their on-the-ground presence faded.
Just because we're not out there marching and caravanning, that doesn't mean that the movement has stopped. We have other things to do that's a part of the movement.
That's Rosie Henderson. She became a fixture at local protest. Demonstrators sometimes call her Miss Rosie or Mama Rose. Protesters spent months marching around Jefferson Square Park last year. On Saturday, they plan to return to the square. Tamika Palmer, Taylor's mother, is organizing an afternoon of protest there to mark 1 year since her daughter was shot and killed by Louisville Metro Police. Henderson sees the event as a chance to reignite the movement for justice.
To LMPD and the mayor and everyone involved, we still gonna keep applying pressure. Us as a whole in the movement, we wanna unify. That's a day that we're gonna come together unified as one.
None of the officers involved in the no-knock raid were charged with Taylor's death. One officer, Brett Hankison, was fired and charged with wanton endangerment for shooting into a neighboring apartment. Two additional officers have since been fired. Henderson says the lack of legal consequences is hurtful. Without closure, the pain of Taylor's death still feels fresh.
That was a slap in the face. That was no justice at all. You know, it's like that they don't care and they didn't get held accountable for what they did. And, you know, we tarred. And it's time to take a stand.
Christopher 2X is a local civil rights leader who has been in touch with Taylor's family since the day after she was killed. He says he still thinks about the days surrounding her death.
I vividly remember being invited into that space where she lost her life a few days after her killing and getting the phone call the next day after the killing from her family. Pain was on display.
2X hopes young people take a stand at Saturday's protest and beyond. While he would have liked to see the justice system work in favor of Taylor's family, 2X says the court shouldn't be the only avenue for change. Instead, he encourages creative ways to rally the city together.
I believe young people and others have the power for change and a continuum change by using their voices, using their intellects, to try to engage those who are connected to situations that they feel frustrated about.
Henderson, one of the protest leaders, says plans are already in the works to push the ongoing justice movement forward. For example, fellow protest leader Shamika Parrish Wright has announced she's running for mayor. Henderson says demonstrators will also continue pressuring the state to pass Breonna's Law. It would ban no-knock warrants and require officers to wear body cameras while conducting searches. Louisville passed a similar law last summer.
We're going to keep marching until they hear us and do something about it. Don't say they're going to do something about it. This is going to come. We may sign this. We want some bills signed, like now. We're tired of hearing excuses.
Saturday's rally at Jefferson Square Park begins at 1 p.m. Protesters will start marching at 3. I'm John Boyle in Louisville.
And as we mentioned, there are numerous events going on around the state, around the country, around the world in honor of the anniversary of Breonna Taylor's death. There's a gathering in Bowling Green, Kentucky this weekend, organized by the Bowling Green Freedom Walkers, that will include speakers, a march, and a clothing collection for the homeless. Founding member Karika Nelson says her group has been busy since coming together last summer in the wake of the police-related deaths of Taylor and the Minneapolis resident George Floyd and others. That is at midday tomorrow in downtown Bowling Green. You may have heard us salute to a Speed Art Museum exhibit that's coming up next month honoring Breonna Taylor. Artist Amy Sherald originally painted work for a Vanity Fair cover last fall, and this will be the first time the painting on which that cover came out is shown publicly. According to a news release, the exhibition is called Promise, Witness, Remembrance. It will also display works by prominent national artists such as Hank Willis Thomas and sculptor and performance artist Nick Cave. It will also feature artists with Louisville ties like sculptor Ed Hamilton and painter Sam Gilliam. And you may have also heard us mention Senate Bill 211 that's making its way through the Kentucky General Assembly. It passed the Kentucky Senate yesterday. It could become a crime to taunt a police officer in Kentucky under the bill, among other elements. The Republican-backed bill would criminalize anyone who, quote, accosts, insults, taunts, or challenges a law enforcement officer. Democratic lawmakers and opponents argued the proposal could be used to unfairly target peaceful protesters. So that's where we stand on Senate Bill 211. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about dealing with grief amid the pandemic and amid racism and racial violence. We're going to be joined by the Reverend Mira Kasi Corlett and Reverend Brenda Burney, who are both grief counselors and work with grieving people. It's coming up after a break on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Well, this past year has left many people dealing with grief. We've lost thousands of people across Kentucky from COVID-19, and you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who hasn't been touched by coronavirus-related loss in some way. Grief has also been very real for people who have dealt with the reopening of the wounds of racism and racist violence. And here to talk about dealing with those and other types of grief are Reverend Mira Kasi Corlett, Senior Pastor of Okolona Baptist Church. Reverend Corlett, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. And also welcome to Reverend Brenda Burney, who is a board-certified chaplain and grief specialist. And Reverend Burney, welcome to the program. You're associated with the University of Louisville Health, right?
Yes, I am. And thank you for allowing me to be here in this conversation.
It is good to have you both with us. And again, we'd love to hear from our listeners if you have thoughts as we talk about grief amid the coronavirus and everything else that's been going on over the past year. Give us a call, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. We're on Twitter. You can send us a tweet if you'd rather do it that way. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Well, let me start with you, Reverend Corlett, and talk about just a little bit about what you do as in terms of grief and grief counseling at Okanagan Baptist Church. What kind of services do you provide to people?
Well, at Okanagan Baptist Church, I'm the senior pastor. I've been senior pastor there for 4 years. But one of the reasons that I was contacted is because, like the other reverend, I have spent most of my career in chaplaincy. I was a chaplain for nearly 25 years. 20 of that was at Central State Hospital, and then before that at MedSurg Hospital. So I've worked a great deal with grief over the years. And then as senior pastor, of course, I provide services like funerals and memorial services, being with families, caring for those who've been diagnosed with serious illnesses and their families. So exactly pastoral care like I was taught in seminary.
So as everyone has been hit hard by the coronavirus, I assume there are some, if not many, in your church community who have lost loved ones, if not members of your community. And that's talk about a little bit about how that's been over the past year, dealing with the grief and the fallout from everything that's happened with COVID-19.
Well, we have had members of our congregation who have had good friends and family members who have died from COVID. And this kind of leads me into something that we were talking about earlier, is the way that we've been inhibited in being able to express our grief. And when you brought that up, the funerals were very small. And our church is a family church. And what I mean by that is we really surround families when they're going through grief and loss. And so it was very difficult for us to find creative ways to reach out to people, because the funeral homes kept the visitations and the funerals small. And we weren't able to take casseroles to the homes and do those kinds of things, except for drop off on the porches. So one of the creative things that we did is at Christmas, the week before Christmas, our church had luminaries representing members of our church and folks who are important to our congregation on the front steps. And within those, and they had names on them. And then within those, we had green candles to celebrate and honor their lives, like the compassion light that our governor has recommended. And so we had a number of the luminaries that had green candles rather than white candles. And it was a sign to our community and everyone who passed by that we were honoring those in a creative way that didn't involve us getting together. And of course, people wore masks when they dropped them by. And so we've had to think out of the box. We've had to be flexible. But I think that that's not different than everyone has had to be regarding the coronavirus and the pandemic.
Let me turn to you, Reverend Brenda Burney, because in the hospital, of course, in the hospital, in the medical setting, there are risks of transmission. And that has really, I would think, affected how you've been able to connect or deal with families who want to be with their loved ones as they're in their final moments, but are unable to, right?
Sure, yes. I was thanking the senior pastor there for reminding me of one of the things that we've done here at the hospital. I started Reef for Grief, and we tie a ribbon each week on the reef for the names of those that people have passed. And so since COVID, we added the green ribbon. So those green ribbons represent all those individuals who have passed here at this hospital. And it's really beautiful. The other colors are kind of pastels, but then this green just stands out. And it's really pretty. It's been very difficult communicating with families and also providing support. You know, we have done a lot of it through telephone, through, you know, that type of media, and also a Zoom call for that patient who is suffering with COVID or that is their medical issue. And so it's been very difficult being able to talk with the family, express whatever their needs are. And I think for me, understanding that in this time with the violence out in the streets and all, it's just beyond, it really has made it difficult not being able to see the person face-to-face or contact and to be able to be safe one to another.
Well, let's talk about racism and race-related violence, because that is a unique or different form of grief than what we've experienced with the coronavirus. But Reverend Bernier, sure. what's been your experience dealing with people who are afraid or have lost loved ones because of racial violence?
Well, it's a different type of grief. I know that when parents lose their children, that in itself has its own type of grief. Grief, first of all, is just so different and difficult. I like to say that grief is God's grace to us, because it helps us feel through our emotions and through the process of the suffering that we go through. Because just defining grief is a feeling that's deep. It's a deep distress caused by loss, disappointment, traumatic experiences, death, things that are unfortunate that we cannot wrap our fingers around. We can't hold it in hand. So therefore, the loss is the issue there. And so with that loss, especially when it's unexpected, then we have no time to respond. We have no time to maybe to put a hand on it and try to keep it from happening, you know. Yeah. So it's a deep, it's very, very difficult.
Reverend Corlett, talk about some of the conversations of the dialogue you've had in your community about everything that's gone on with race-related violence and racism that's happened in conjunction parallel to the coronavirus pandemic and the grief associated with that.
I think one of the things that's been the most difficult that I have experienced is just when I think about exactly what she has said, and that is when I listened to Ms. Palmer this morning, I had a great deal of empathy for her, just of losses that I've had. But there is no loss like the loss of a child. Part of my training was at University Hospital and also at Norton Children's Hospital years ago. And so I worked with a great deal of people who had to deal with the deaths of children. And there's just nothing like it. I believe that one of the things that we are called to do as the church is directly out of Micah, and that is to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. And so because I believe those things and I walk humbly in peace, I have been a supporter of the peaceful protest. I am a follower of the ideas of Martin Luther King, who was inspired by Gandhi and St. Yeah. Francis. So one of the things I wanted to tell you about being creative is I think we can learn from our young people. And there's a young woman in our church who is in the eighth grade this year. And so she inspired some of us on Breonna Taylor's birthday to send 27 cards to the Attorney General for Breonna's birthday, and on each one of those birthday cards to ask for justice. Awesome. And I was so inspired by what she did that I did that. And then during our weekly broadcast of our worship services, I talked about her in my sermon that week. I talked about how Willa was doing something peacefully, honorably, in that vein, so that she might honor Brianna and Brianna's family. And, you know, I don't know what happened to those cards, but I wrote on some of my cards that I hope that they were given to the family.
I'm curious.
Hundreds of cards came in.
I'm curious what, if any, response there was from the Attorney General's office.
I put my return address on them, but did not receive that. But, you know, that didn't surprise me. But I want to tell you, there was something empowering, because so much of that time, because of the COVID virus, because of the lockdown, because of the violence that we saw, and there was a part of helplessness that one feels. And so one of the things that is the chaplains and pastors that we do is to empower grieving, to empower bereavement, because it gives you a sense of comfort and as if you're not helpless.
You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. And we are talking about grief with Reverend Mara Cossey Corlett from she's senior pastor at Okolona Baptist Church. Sorry about that. And Reverend Brenda Burney is with us, who is a grief specialist and chaplain associated with the University of Louisville Health. We welcome your calls, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Reverend Burney, I think some people sometimes find it difficult or even uncomfortable trying to help someone who is grieving. We talked about the loss of a child. What advice do you have for people who are not sure how to approach people, how to help people who are grieving, but you want to be of some help, but you don't want to, maybe they're worried about maybe upsetting them more. But what's your advice for people who want to help people who are grieving?
Well, personally, I take on, there's a poem by Howard Thurman, who actually is one of the 20th century scholars who Martin Luther King, as a matter of fact, he had his book, Jesus and the Disenfranchised, in his pocket when he was assassinated. But this poem that he writes, it says, "I share with you the agony of your grief, that I share with you the agony of your grief, that agony of your heart, and find the echo within my own heart. And I also do it knowing that I cannot step into your pain, but I can walk alongside you." And so I'm the same way. I try to instill in people to know that you can have empathy, as the pastor was saying, but you cannot begin to say, "Here's how I feel." And because grief is so unique to each individual, we can't even say that, "Oh, that was like Uncle Hollis or Uncle Jones," or that you're grieving just like he is. No, it's unique to each and every individual. And as a community, African-Americans live in a community of grief all around them. And what I mean by that is that they have grief from the loss of jobs, loss of people, loss of having the privilege to just be free in the grocery store. And so all of these things come into play. And on top of that, during this COVID time frame, we have a unique way of grieving. And within those rituals, it includes the funeral ritual itself, food, family, fellowship, and festivities. And so within all of that, we haven't been able to come to the funeral like we did, bring food to the funeral. Everybody is a part of the neighborhood there. And again, the church is very important in the Black community. And because we haven't been able to come in the church like we once did, that is just important. And for me, as a grandparent, I always think about the senior isolation since COVID. We as grandparents, we can't hug that grandchild or kiss them or, you know, do that visitation we once did. And myself, like the pastor, yeah. I had my first assignment was at Norton. It sounds like our paths have crossed. At Norton was labor and delivery. So my first, I think my first funeral was for a baby. And so then I did the Compassionate Care Friends for a year and a half. I facilitated that support group. So
good.
I hope that helped.
Oh, wonderful. Reverend Corlett, I'm going to give you the last word. Got about a minute left. Where do you stand? Where does it stand now? And I'm not sure. Don't have the policy in front of me, the state policy, in terms of having in-person funerals now. Can you have them on a small basis at this point?
I think that we need to continue. I mean, I've been one of the pastors. Our church is opening for in-person worship on Palm Sunday. We're putting into all kinds of care. And so I've been, one of my dearest friends from a Central State died during COVID. And so her funeral had to be very small. I conducted the funeral. And I have been so impressed with our Kentucky area funeral directors who have worked with families to give families what they need. I do want to put one more thing in, though. Sometimes we can be too quiet about our grief. Mm-hmm. We, it's particularly in the white community, you know, it's something that's very private. We don't talk about it. And one of the things that I think that we're doing is we're learning from each other. I was, I saw shirts once, you know, there's these rest in peace t-shirts that are really important in grieving in many of black communities. But I just saw a shirt the other day that said, ask me about Breonna Taylor. Mm. That's all it said. It didn't have a picture of her or anything, but it gave that person an opportunity to tell her story. I think sometimes we need the opportunity to just tell our story.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much, sure. Reverend Mara Cassie Corlett and Reverend Brenda Burney. Great advice, and it was such a joy to talk to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having you.
Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.